Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 25th of November. This hour of the program, Barack Obama's program for stimulating the U.S. economy has been called a New Deal. We'll be talking about that the first hour of our program today. When he addressed a demoralized nation, our guest writes in a recent article in the Christian Science Monitor, a demoralized economic philosophy had caused the high-flying economy of the 1920s to go into free fall. In the days before he took office, the banking system had completely collapsed, and Roosevelt prescribed principles to accomplish a restoration of honesty in our society, applicable to remoralizing our current demoralized economy. So, how would this New Deal take fashion? We'll be talking about that this hour. And when we talk about beginning a new direction in this country with new ideas and new reforms that will create jobs and fuel long-term economic growth, what are we looking at? How much will it cost? We have a great guest with us this hour who's a student and scholar of the Great Depression. Our guest is Professor Robert McIlvain, Elizabeth Chisholm Professor of Arts and Letters and Chair of the Department of History at Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi. He is author of The Great Depression. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, that's okay, and that's talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Professor Robert McIlvain, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
Yeah. So let's talk about a New Deal. Is that what Barack Obama needs to do? He seems to be outlining a massive stimulus package. What is reminiscent of what FDR needed to do? What parallels do you see?
Well, some of it is reminiscent of what FDR did. And some of it is going to go a lot further. When you were quoting from the piece I had yesterday in the Christian Science Monitor, I should point out that one of the things they did was correct what they thought was a mistake in terms of a demoralized economic philosophy. It had a hyphen there because I didn't mean demoralized in the sense of not being optimistic, but demoralized in the sense of morality having been taken out of economic philosophy. And I think that's what had happened in the 1920s with the idea that the free market is God and we shouldn't intervene, and basically that economics is a science, perhaps a dismal science, but a science all the same, and therefore that morality has no role in it. Traditionally, people have always thought that the justification for certain economic policies from the government was based on the idea that it was going to in some way produce the common good. But as a totally free market economy became more and more accepted, and certainly that was the case in the 1920s, the idea that any sort of moral end had anything to do with it was taken out. I think that returned very strongly under the New Deal with the impact of the Depression and remained somewhat the case through the middle of the 20th century when we had higher tax rates on upper income brackets, relatively strong labor unions, government regulation, resulted in a period of extended and fairly widespread prosperity. And the idea that morality should have no part in the economy or in economics and that the free market should reign was discredited after 1929, but in short, it made a comeback beginning around 1980 and I think has produced much the same results as it did in the 1920s.
And when you talk about morality, what are you talking about?
Talking about the idea that it's not going to just produce something that's very good for the very few, but is going to produce ends that don't leave out the majority of people. And this was always the sort of underlying justification throughout earlier history, not to say that it was often actually resulted in that, but that the idea was, just the idea of kings, for instance, falling into trouble and having bread riots or something if they weren't producing something that distributed something to the general masses. The other big change, though, that had occurred by the 1920s was that we had a mass production economy for the first time coming out of World War I, and mass production requires mass consumption. And so for the first time, seriously, in the 1920s, we needed to find some way to get people to buy a whole lot more, which may ring a bell these days with what the problem seems to be right now. And that meant tearing down traditional values, the values of saving for a rainy day, of looking towards the future, of not going into debt, of not buying things unless you really needed them. All of that had to be broken down in order to increase mass consumption to soak up all the production that was coming off the production lines. And that was done in the 20s through advertising and ultimately through providing people with credit to buy things. And there's a lot more detail to that that we can go into,
sure.
But that's what produced the problem.
Mm-hmm. There's other. Can you also talk about this huge gap between those who make so much money in this society and those of the masses who don't make as much money? I'm interested in this continual debate when we talk about bailing out the auto company. I was watching a show last night in which somebody was criticizing the unions, of course, for getting these terrific packages with health benefits, et cetera, and not putting and making that to be as equal a part of the problem as those who are running the companies and don't have very much vision, so nobody's buying their cars, and they're making millions and billions of dollars a year. There's an issue about basic fairness here that I wonder how Roosevelt addressed and how you would think Obama needs to address the issue of fairness.
Well, Roosevelt started off trying to keep business on the side of what he was doing, and things were so bad when he took over in 1933 that initially, most of business, except for the most extreme people opposed to a Democrat or any sort of liberal philosophy, went along with it. They needed to be saved. Within a year or two, as things got a little bit better, and they certainly didn't get all that much better quickly, they started turning against the New Deal once again. But he was initially trying to have a sort of comprehensive approach that would include everyone. Once business turned against him and the public attitude was so hostile to business, by the time he was running for re-election in 1936, he just decided that business was going to oppose him no matter what he did. Business was unpopular, and therefore he would go on a more class-based approach, and was saying by the time of 1936 that the powers that be have never been so opposed to a leader as they are to me, and I welcome their hatred. And so he was going along there with a split between ordinary people and those at the top. But the question you raise about people talking about what the auto workers or any other unions are getting and blaming them for the problem seems on the face of it to be absolutely absurd if you compare, you know, well, maybe they are getting higher wages, certainly they are, than their counterparts in other parts of the world, at least in some other parts of the world. On the other hand, they may not be getting nearly as many benefits from the government as some people in other parts of the world, and so they may need more money. But you compare somebody who's making $35 an hour and we're outraged at that, with the people who cart off hundreds of millions of dollars after they run their companies into the ground, and there really is no comparison at all.
Right. Paul Krugman had an article recently, I'm sure you saw it, in which he looked at the difference between Roosevelt's nomination in 32 and his reelection smashing victory in 36, and talks about how he changed his philosophy, cutting spending, raising taxes, precipitating, Krugman says, an economic relapse that drove the unemployment rate back into double digits and led to a major defeat in the 38 midterm elections. Is there something that can inform our situation now in that reelection and a change of philosophy?
Yeah, well, there's two different things there. The change of philosophy for the reelection was much more along the lines I was just mentioning, that Roosevelt decided to throw his lot in with unions and the working class, which he had not particularly done in 1932 or even early in the New Deal. And on the basis of that, he won an overwhelming re-election. During 1936, he pumped up the amount of money going into the WPA and other programs, which provided not only some boost to the economy, but a big boost to his re-election campaign. But the thing about Roosevelt is that he never really abandoned the idea that we needed to have balanced budgets. He didn't disagree on that, for instance, with Herbert Hoover, The difference basically was that Hoover was an ideologue who believed that he knew how things operated and that was the only way they would operate. And Roosevelt had famously said in the 1932 campaign that he believed that what the people wanted was bold, persistent experimentation. Take an idea and try it. If it doesn't work, throw it out and try another one. If that doesn't work, try another one. Hoover, on the other hand, although he never put it in these words, essentially his approach was take the idea because there is only one. If it doesn't work, try it again. If it doesn't work, try it again. And so Roosevelt was much more pragmatic, willing to do other things. But basically, the problem, as I see it, with the New Deal not ending the Depression for a number of years was that, not that it couldn't have, but that Roosevelt wouldn't be bold enough because he was too afraid of deficits. He was willing to spend money and go into deficit spending to keep people from starving, but he was always afraid. And so what he did really just before the 36 election, but after that was in the bag, was to begin to cut back greatly on the WPA and other public work spending. And indeed, as Krugman said, that precipitated a new collapse that was just about as bad as the original one.
Until the war came.
Until the war came. And that's the whole point, really, as far as spending being a way to get out of this. There were a couple of economists writing as early as 1930 who said, imagine what would happen if war were declared tomorrow. The government would just start spending on the military and not worry about where the money was coming from. Everybody would find employment and the Depression would be over. So they suggested, why not just pretend that war has been declared or declare war on the Depression and spend that way? And really, that would have been the solution, but Roosevelt was unwilling to do it until a real war came along.
Interesting. Can we talk, because I'm not sure how this factors in. I don't understand this. This idea of the fireside chat, this idea of Roosevelt having this calming, restoring confidence influence on this country, and much has been said about Obama's talk. I don't know if his news conferences, the rollout of his economic team have caused the stock market to go up in the last couple of days. I don't understand that. Can you explain that to me?
Well, one of the odd things about what went on with Hoover and Roosevelt is that Hoover kept saying that all that was needed was to restore confidence, and he wasn't right. A lot more than that was needed, but that was a significant part of it. Much as is the case today, we have far greater problems than just a lack of confidence, but the lack of confidence plays a significant role. The problem was that Hoover was just totally unable to instill confidence. Certainly, as the Depression went on, he did some things that went beyond what had been done in previous economic collapses. The government was more active than it had been in the past. But people increasingly turned on Hoover, and he was just absolutely incapable of restoring confidence. Well, Roosevelt comes along, and of course the thing that people most remember as a quote from Roosevelt in his inaugural address is, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, which is essentially what Hoover had been saying all along. But while people scoffed when Hoover would say we need to restore confidence, people loved it when Roosevelt said it. And particularly striking was the fact that the banking system had totally collapsed in the final days before Roosevelt took office. And he called Congress into session, which was not what normally happened at that time. The Congress didn't meet for 13 months after a new Congress was elected, but he called an extraordinary session for the end of that week and passed an emergency banking bill, which had in fact been drawn up largely by Hoover holdovers in the Treasury Department and some of the bankers, and not the sort of people the public had any confidence in. But Roosevelt sent this bill over. It was passed without even being read in Congress. And then Roosevelt went on the air with the first of his fireside chats and explained banking to the American public in terms that the public could understand. Mm-hmm. And as comedian Will Rogers said, he explained it, explained banking in terms that even the bankers could understand. And he told people that who had been engaged in runs on banks and getting their money out of these failing banks, that those banks that reopened the next morning would be safe. And miraculously, the people went and started putting money back in them. So this ability to instill confidence that Roosevelt had, and it seems that Obama may have, is really significant.
We welcome phone calls for our guests, and we'll take them in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're learning, refreshing our history here, lessons about what happened during FDR's massive stimulus plan during the Great Depression and whether or not we can call what Barack Obama has planning in the planning stages and what he needs to do is a new deal. Our guest is the Elizabeth Chisholm Professor of Arts and Letters, Chair of the Department of History at Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi, author of The Great Depression and several other books as well. Professor Robert McElvain is with us. To your phone calls momentarily, send an email if you can't get through or if you'd prefer to send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, it's our November open line, so call with your suggestions of programs you'd like to hear between 9 and 11. We go to phone calls right now, starting with Bob from Madison. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I've been living in this country for 37 years, and this is the first time I'm ever calling a talk radio.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, I value your program very much, but I just want to make a statement, and I'll take your comment off the air. Now, the present, this thing, about 2 years ago, I accidentally stumbled on a book called Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. I think a lot of, when I mentioned this book, a lot of people have heard about this
book.
Okay. Now, if you see the present crisis, it's exactly being described in that book. How those big people like CEOs and all this like AIG and Lehman Brothers, Bernstein, they all joined together and conspire against the federal government. And these people, they want to take the whole government down because those in that book, as it described, they didn't like the regulation, therefore they're going against the government. So finally, the whole government, everybody collapses, the middle-class people collapse. There's kind of a revolution. And that's exactly what's happening now. When I hear Henry Paulson comes for a $700 billion loan with a 2.5-page proposal, now these three big executives from GM and Ford and all come without any proposal at all asking for a $25 billion. Now, when you look at all these things, I am very confident that all these CEOs are joined together and they want to take this whole government down and they want to change the whole government now, especially kill the middle-class people. And I'm really afraid this Obama has got a big problem because all the smart people who can solve the problem, they're all in one group, including, I think the whole thing started with Alan Greenspan, because Alan Greenspan, hero was Ayn Rand, who wrote this book. And in fact, about a month ago, he came to the Congress and agreed how he was wrong. So I'd like to take your comment off air.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for calling. Professor McElwain.
Yes, well, that was a striking moment when Alan Greenspan admitted that his faith in the unfettered free market had been misplaced. And I don't see any sort of massive conspiracy against the middle class on the part of these people. On the other hand, they have not been particularly concerned about what happened to the middle class or anyone else as they were accumulating more and more money. And it is very striking how these people who philosophically have been opposed to government intervention in anything are coming around so quickly asking for money for themselves. The most famous Depression-era song was, "Brother, can you spare a dime?" These people seem to be saying, "Brother, can you spare a trillion?" and the brothers are the taxpayers of the United States, the ordinary people. So the whole idea that government intervention is bad is really not something that most of the people who espouse that idea ever really believed. They have traditionally been in favor of government intervention if that intervention was favorable to their own interests and opposed to it if it was not. I mean, you can go back to the 19th century, and while all these people were talking about free enterprise and laissez-faire, they're also favoring huge government subsidies and land grants to build railroads. They're certainly in favor of massive tariffs that were really unnecessary except to increase profits, any sort of government intervention that was favorable to them. As Michael Harrington, the socialist writer, had said in the 1960s, the basic idea that these people have is socialism for the rich and free enterprise for the poor, and we're seeing that to a greater extent than ever right now.
Can you talk a little bit more about the kinds of jobs that would really stimulate the economy that Obama should be looking at and which jobs would best fuel long-term economic growth?
Yes, I think that's a very important point. There are a variety of ways to try to put stimulus out there, and the problem really is that we are in a situation now that is similar to that at the end of the 20s, where the problem of people not having enough money to buy the things, the goods and services that were out there, had been solved for quite a while by providing credit to them and letting them buy these goods and services when they didn't have the money. But by 1929, even before the stock market crash, people's credit was running short and they were no longer able even to use their current income for new purchases because a lot of that was dedicated to paying off what they had bought on credit in the past. Well, that has happened to a much, much larger extent. The credit is vastly more in recent years than it was in the 20s. But what happened at that point after the crash in 1929 was that people at that point were not that far separated from their traditional values that they had been somewhat weaned away from during that decade. And they pretty quickly cut back and really didn't want to spend anything that wasn't absolutely necessary. And so that starts this downward spiral where there are more goods that are unsold and more people are laid off because the goods aren't selling and then they have less money and so on.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't happened in recent decades. For instance, after the stock market crash in 1987, there was only a little dip in consumption. Because people, we have a whole generation, perhaps two generations, brought up on the idea that we just consume and consume and consume, that we buy things on credit and don't worry about it. And people, after the 87 crash, went back to that quickly. The difference now is that so many people are so deeply in debt, in many cases having taken all sorts of money out of their homes and second mortgages and so forth, and now finding that their homes aren't even worth that, that people are really scared now and much more in the situation they were in 1929. And so simply giving tax cuts, for instance, or even rebates, given the psychology of people at the moment, probably isn't going to result in a really big increase in spending to stimulate the economy. People are more likely to try to pay down their debt, which is a very sensible thing to do for individuals, but doesn't solve the macroeconomic problem. So I think the government spending directly is a much better approach, and then the question becomes the one you asked of what's the best way to spend that, what sorts of projects. There were, of course, large projects and public works that were undertaken on a massive scale during the New Deal. There were also vastly smaller enterprises under the WPA. And the Civilian Conservation Corps, a whole host of others that were providing jobs for people. And all that's good, but I think what we really need to emphasize at the moment is what might be called a Green Projects Administration instead of a Works Project Administration, to try to target the spending in a way that not only provides jobs for people at the moment and provides money to help fuel and stimulate the economy, but that will make for putting the country in a better position economically in the future, using energy more efficiently, and doing the sorts of things that the future economy will be based on.
Let's go to more phone calls. We go to Roger next from Sherwood. Hi, Roger.
Good morning. How are you both?
Fine. You, Roger?
Good. You know, you think about these fireside chats or whatever when these presidents come on and they talk to you, and with that in mind, you say restoring confidence. And I don't think, you know, they say perception is reality. And if your perception is such that you believe that not good things are coming, be it true or not, it's your perception. And thus, I think people really do want to have hope and confidence in the society that they live. But when the politicians and some of these experts come on, and they say, well, you can't say this because if you really give them the truth, then the fact is things are going to continue to downward spiral. And so it's almost like when you hear about church attendance goes up when things seem bleak overall. And I just wonder if the economy somewhat looks to their politicians where we'd like to believe and have confidence in our country, but we can't because we don't have leadership.
Yes, well, I think that's a serious problem. Are we on?
Yeah, we're on.
Okay, I was just hearing dead air, and I wasn't sure whether.
No, we're just here. We're hearing you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. I think that that's exactly the problem, and there are a number of things that are more dangerous in the current situation than in 1929. Notably, the fact that there were more or less balanced budgets in the late 20s, whereas we've had these enormous deficits prior to the collapse this time, and so it makes the creation of new deficits to stimulate the economy more difficult. But one thing that is much better now is that when that collapse occurred, Herbert Hoover had just completed his, well, was just completing his first year in office, and it was another 3 years to a new presidential election. This time it occurred a matter of weeks before a new election, and so there's a very short time to wait for the change from the administration in which people have no confidence. And that's obvious from the opinion polls about President Bush at the moment. There were no scientific opinion polls in the time of Hoover, but had there been, I imagine his approval rating would have been around the low 20s where the current president is.
Mm-hmm.
And so having a fresh start, and especially a fresh start with someone who seems to have the, well, the sort of ability that President-elect Obama's opponents mocked him for during the campaign of being able to give a good speech and that sort of thing, that's not all there is to being a good president, but it's a major part of it. Roosevelt, for instance, had this ability to connect with people over the radio that is really almost unbelievable. One of my other books on the Depression, Down and Out in the Great Depression, is a collection of letters that people wrote to Franklin and Eleanor.
Oh, really?
Roosevelt.
Oh, I'd like to see that.
And, yeah, it's just come out again in a 25th anniversary edition.
Great.
And the letters, I mean, and the number of people who wrote these letters, there are about 15 million of them that were written, and I went through, I guess, about 15,000. I certainly didn't go through them all. But the affection that people have, but more than that, the feeling of personal connection, over and over again, they will say, you told me in your radio address. they feel he was talking directly to them over the radio. And this sort of personal connection made a huge difference in simply, even though the Depression wasn't solved, helping people to cope with it, to live through it, to benefit from the New Deal programs that were, if they weren't solving the Depression, at least making it easier to live with. And that ability to connect on a personal level is something that I don't think any politician has had in the television era. Ronald Reagan was called the great communicator, and he was good at it, but nothing like Roosevelt was over the radio. In fact, I often say the only person I know who could get that sort of personal connection with people over television is the late Fred Rogers.
Yes.
Fred Rogers could do it, but only if you were below the age of five. But Roosevelt could do that with adults over the radio, and it was a remarkable ability.
You know, Fred Rogers did that for me when I was 50, so...
Well,
that's okay.
Most people above the age of five, I didn't want to listen to him at all, but I remember one of my children, I'd come home and she'd say, Mr. Rogers told me today. But the thing is, Roosevelt could do that with adults.
Right. Don't you find, I know that things move a lot more rapidly these days, but it strikes me as so unusual, and some have called for President Bush to resign, as you know, early, but it's very, this period before January 20th seems to be a very long period of time, and we have this odd thing happening where President-elect Obama is having one nationally televised press conference after another. There's another one today and seems to be acting as the president, but he's not really the president. I think everybody's fearful about what could happen economically in this country because things are happening so quickly and they're not good before January 20th.
Well, that's exactly right. And at least the period between the election and the new president taking over is shorter now than it was in 1933. It wasn't until March 4th at that point that the new president took over. And that period was the period of the absolute bottom of the Depression. And during that period, Hoover kept asking Roosevelt to join with him in making statements and to endorse what Hoover was doing.
And, of course, on the one hand, Roosevelt believed that those were the wrong policies, but even if he had thought they were the right policies, the last thing he wanted to do was associate himself with the discredited Hoover. And so he simply refused to do that, more or less ignored them, and Hoover kept getting madder and madder that he wouldn't do these things. But Roosevelt realized, again, that part of what he was going to be able to do was to try to instill confidence in people. And the last thing he needed to do if he was going to instill confidence was to embrace Hoover and all his failed and discredited mm-hmm. policies. Another aspect of that, and how much of this was actually conscious in Roosevelt's mind, we don't know, but things reaching an absolute bottom just before he took over was beneficial to him politically. The only way to go was up, it seemed, and so things being at their worst at that point. This time, I think that Obama seems to be more concerned with trying to keep things from getting that bad before he takes office, with trying to at least begin to have some sort of policies aimed at recovery in place or ready to be passed almost immediately, perhaps even passed by Congress before January 20th so he can sign them almost immediately. But he also does have to be concerned about not seeming to be getting too close to Bush because people have no confidence in him.
Yeah. Thanks, Roger, very much for your call. We go to Dan from White Lake now, and one line is open at 800-486-8655. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Hi.
I hear a couple of things that I think have a great impact on the banking situation that I don't hear anybody talking about. One of the things that went out the window with the 1986 Tax Reform Act was the ability of the IRS to impose a 70% tax on what they deemed was the unreasonable portion of your compensation. And another thing that had plenty of Republican and Democratic support when the banks wanted to go nationwide and griped that they would have to comply with usury laws in 50 states, of which there are 48 of the 50 states had a 12% usury law. Only two differed. And instead of establishing a national usury law, they just threw usury laws out the window. So now we've got car loan, payday loan joints and Wells Fargo and other banks charging hundreds and hundreds of percent interest and making more in fees than they do in investments. I'm wondering whether your guest would agree that those two things, the elimination of the tax on unreasonable compensation and the horrendous interest rates that all of our politicians caved in on and sold us down the river, had as much of an impact. I note that of the many people reporting $1 billion in income, that's 20,000 times the median income of the country. 20,000 times.
Mm-hmm. Professor McElveen.
Well, normally people like me try to hedge answers on such things, but let me answer this with one word. Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is such a big part of the problem, not just the change in laws, but those changes facilitated this concentration of wealth and income to just extraordinary levels. And I was writing a couple of years ago about how a collapse was in the offing because we were going through almost exactly what had been done in the late 1920s. And the amount of income, leaving aside wealth, but the amount of income going to the top 1% and the top 0.1%, even 0.01%, was back by 2005 to where it had been in 1928. And it seems to me that it's immoral, it's unjust, but even leaving all that aside, it just doesn't work economically when you have an economy that needs mass consumption, that you can't have so much of the wealth and income in the hands of so few. And it's just outrageous. The change, I don't have the exact figures in front of me, I'm just doing this from memory, but the average CEO compensation compared to the average worker was somewhere around, I believe, 35 to 1 around the late 1970s, and it's gotten up to more than 300 to
Woo!
1 in recent years. And
incredible.
It's just, you know, I mean, it's... And that really is the most fundamental problem. These people have been the sort of people that written about in Bonfire of the Vanities, the people who are trying to be masters of the universe, and they have become masters of the universe, but really at the expense of the rest of us.
Right. And then I always ask, what the heck do you do with all that money? You just build house after house, or you have jet after jet? 15
exactly,
cars?
That really is the point, because they're not going to use it to buy things. You know, if they've got enough income that their share of buying, say, automobiles ought to be that they buy 500 of them a year, they're not going to do that, even luxury cars. What they do instead is the only thing they know to do with their money and try to make more money. And so as the more of the money is at the very top, it's not among the people who will buy things to keep the economy going. Instead, it's with people who will use it to speculate. And so it's a problem on both sides of the equation. There's not enough to be keeping the economy going by buying goods and services, and there's more of this money that's just there for idle speculation, bidding up prices on things way beyond what they're really worth and ultimately creating a collapse.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dan, for your call. Tom from River Falls. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi,
Long
Tom.
Long time no here.
Yeah, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Hey, I wanted to mention to your guest whether you heard about this book published in 2004 by Professor Cass Sunstein from the University of Chicago. The book was called The Second Bill of Rights, and the subtitle is called FDR's Unfinished Revolution and Why We Need It More Than Ever.
No, I'm not familiar with the book, but I agree with the premise.
Oh, my God. You know, Cass Sunstein, he's the most cited law professor in the United States. And he says in this book here that basically what the speech was is the State of the Union of 1944, and he says it was arguably the most important political speech of the 20th century. And it basically it lists eight economic rights that he felt, you know, America should enact, and it, you know, I can read them if you want me to, Kathleen. But this is basically what he was trying to fulfill in his New Deal. This would have been the crowning glory of it. And he mentions, of course, that the Republicans have been trying to dismantle the New Deal, you know, for the last 70 years, and Bush in 2004 tried to privatize Social Security, and that's been his goal forever. And yes, I recommend this book.
And give us an idea.
Basically, I guess what Obama's trying to do now.
And give us an idea of what some of the rights are, Tom, without going through, you know, all of them.
The first one, the right to useful and remunerative job in industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. Then it goes into, you know, right to an education, the right of every family to a decent home. And basically eight rights that are economic rights. Now, of course, the conservatives would say that's communism, and that's what they called him anyway when he was implementing the New Deal. But it's basically what the Europeans have and what the Canadians have. And they're not communists, right?
No, I don't think so, Professor McElvin.
Well, if we were to listen to some of the people in the recent campaign, they're all communists, but
socialists. That was a big word this go around. They're socialists.
Yeah. Well, while I'm not familiar with the book, I am familiar with what Roosevelt was calling for in 1944, and yeah, absolutely, that's what is needed. I mean, among other things, reaching the point where we see health care as a right, not as some sort of a privilege that only goes to those who can afford it. And these sorts of things, and the one thing that was done in 1944 was passing the GI Bill of Rights, and this sort of government intervention was very much a part of building up a middle class that was able to sustain a widespread prosperity throughout the middle decades of the 20th century. And that was combined with what, by today's standards, would be extraordinarily high taxes on the highest income brackets. And despite all the hue and cry from wealthy people and conservatives and free market economists about how it kills the goose that lays the golden egg if you start taxing at such high rates, it worked during those periods. And so all this talk about spreading the wealth around and by going back to the level of taxation on the highest income people under Bill Clinton is vastly lower than what it was in the middle of the 20th century. And, you know, you can also go back to when Clinton's changes in taxation were passed in 1993, and this complaint rising from the Republicans. Every single Republican in Congress voted against his budget. They all predicted it would lead to economic collapse. Instead, we had a boom, perhaps unprecedented in our history. Now, that wasn't caused by the tax policy, but at the very least, it's clear that that tax policy didn't prevent it and didn't cause a collapse. And then what we see in more recent years is that the taxes were decreased on the highest income people, and we now have a collapse.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about what we learned from the Great Depression, what we learned from the New Deal, and what we hope to see from President-elect Barack Obama for a new New Deal. Our guest is Professor Robert McIlvaine, Elizabeth Chisholm Professor of Arts and Letters, Chair of the Department of History at Millsaps College, and a scholar of the Great Depression. He's author of The Great Depression and Down and Out in the Great Depression. And we're welcoming phone calls. Thank you for your call, Tom. We have one line open at 800-486-8655. Or send an email if you'd like. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program, it's an open line. You can call with your suggestions for programs you'd like to hear, guests you'd like to have on from 9 to 11 in the morning. Jillian is next from Madison. Hi, Jillian.
Yes, good morning. I'm calling with a couple of questions for your guest, but first a quick comment, and that is, that Mr. Obama appears to be waffling already on the stopping of the tax cuts for the wealthy. And related to that question is, really, the wealthy make most of their money from not income taxes, but from capital gains. And my question is, for your guest, what is his opinion of Mr. Obama choosing Treasury Secretary that will presumably be appointed, Tim Geithner, and also Larry Summers, both of whom were part of the Clinton administration that actually started this whole process of deregulation, which has been at the bottom of what we're dealing with. And that's never talked about.
Okay, we'll talk about it right now. Professor McIlvaine.
Yes, well, I don't think the process of deregulation started with Clinton. I think they bought into it too much after the Republicans took over Congress in 1994 and certainly bear some of the responsibility. On the other hand, generally speaking, and some of the biggest mistakes, for instance, repealing the Glass-Steagall Act, separating commercial from investment banking, occurred very late in the Clinton administration. They were serious mistakes. But I think some of the economic people were doing the right things during most of the Clinton administration. So I'm not that concerned about those particular individuals being in these positions. As far as your first question is concerned, though, I think that that is a mistake. I think the reason for possibly or at least considering postponing repealing the Bush tax cuts on the highest income people is simply to avoid Republican opposition to other things that need to be done right away at the beginning. He certainly will still, at the very least, allow them to expire when they were set to anyway. And I think that's a very important thing. As far as getting most of their money from capital gains, exactly. And the whole idea that you should tax capital gains at a lower rate than earned income. I mean, to me, a lower capital gains tax rate, or as some have been arguing for, a zero capital gains tax that you just get to keep it all, is basically saying if you had to work for your money, we'll tax it. If you didn't have to work for it, you can keep it all. It's sort of an unearned income tax credit. And it makes no sense to me whatsoever. I hope, and I still have a fair amount of confidence, that Obama wants to move more in that direction, and I think any temporary postponement of not reinstituting a higher tax rate on the top people will be only temporary in order to prevent Republicans from blocking other things.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. I know you have to leave in 2 minutes, so we'll take one more phone call. Jim from Galena, hi.
Hi. I am a retired trucking business representative with a machinist union. Retired in 1998. Shortly after the free trade agreement, North America Free Trade Agreement, one of the problems, is, well, there's several problems, but one of the main problems that's causing this recession is all, we're losing all of our manufacturing base is either going to Mexico, most of it's going to Mexico, and what's not going to Mexico is moving outside the North American Free Trade Agreement, either to Brazil or China. And the second reason, one of the main reasons they're moving, is the cost on the health insurance to these companies, and of course some of the cheap labor they get. But the cost on the health insurance itself is about anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500 a month, depending on the factory that you're in. And I don't see how we're going to get our manufacturing base back unless we do something with that free trade agreement and also the cost on the insurance for these corporations. And I'll take the comments off the air.
Thank you, Jim.
Yes, I'll have to answer. As you said, I have to leave in just a minute. I'll answer quickly. The second point is an extremely important one, and one reason why, despite all the current immediate economic problems that need to be dealt with, I hope that the new administration will, and I think it will, move forward on health insurance very quickly. This is a very big problem for American businesses, and many of them have come around to favoring some sort of national health insurance simply because of the competitive disadvantage it puts them at with practically all other countries of the world where the health care is provided by the government. As far as the free trade agreements, it's a very complex thing. I mean, you can't stop having world trade. That will just plunge things further down. But I think we need to be much more careful about having the free trade be fair trade, where provisions are made in the agreements that labor unions are recognized, that environmental standards are enforced, and so forth, so that we play on a level playing field. We do have to trade, but we shouldn't simply be shipping the jobs off to places where workers are totally exploited and the environment is not cared for.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, my, there's so many issues, aren't there? It's just so much. Thank you so much. I'd love to do a show with you about Down and Out in the Great Depression. So we'll get that book and schedule you down the road, if that would be okay.
That would be fine.
Great. Thanks so much. We have to say goodbye to our guest. He has to walk down to teach a class at his school at the Department of History at Millsaps College. So we're just going to keep taking phone calls on the issues that are before us economically and what you would like to see as part, if you'd like to see a new deal. We'll just keep taking your phone calls for the next couple minutes at 800-486-8655. With many thanks to Professor Robert McIlvaine, Elizabeth Chisholm, Professor of Arts and Letters, Chair of the Department of History at Millsaps College in Jackson, Mississippi, and author of The Great Depression and Down and Out in the Great Depression. And we will try to schedule him for an interview. It would be interesting, wouldn't it, Down and Out in the Great Depression? So we'll have him on again sometime down the road here. All right, we have time for a couple more phone calls. Just no guests, but I'd like to hear what you have to say about this new deal. Ken from Three Lakes. No guest, Ken, but we'd like to hear you. Go right ahead.
Yes, I had a chance a few years back where I was testifying in a case, and prior to the case that I was in, there was a gentleman that came before the court. And he was well overspent. He had gone out and bought a new car. He did not have the money. He bought a new boat. He just did everything. And the judge more or less asked him, well, what were you thinking when you didn't have an income to cover these expenditures? And the gentleman said, well, I was told that I should be confident about our economy and that I should go out and spend, and that's what it would take. Well, this man would have had to have gotten a $250,000 a year job. And I'm wondering, comparing that to our economy, are we hoping for some $250,000 job to come along to get us out of this terrible, I think we're in a depression, but we have deficit spending and we have a debt that's unbelievable, never before in the world. How are we going to get rid of ourselves of that debt when we have a deficit forecast for the next 3-4 years?
Mm-hmm. So you're not a believer in deficit spending is okay to stimulate the economy because that's the only way to achieve a recovery in the long run?
Well, my feeling is that if you don't have the money and then you go out and borrow it. Sooner or later, you have to have income to pay that debt. And right now, I believe our interest on our debt is our largest expenditure that we have in this country.
What about getting jobs for people? What about the number of people who are unemployed?
Well, I think that that's fine. But you notice what they did was the first thing they did is they bypassed the big three. They asked them, give us a plan. Well, where did the plan come from? Citigroup. Where did the plan come from? These mortgage companies. They've handed out $700 billion, and there hasn't been a plan submitted.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm saying, yes, if you want to do jobs, that is the way of having income to pay off this debt. But they asked the automobile agencies, or the big three, to come up with a plan. Where was the plan for these other companies, the mortgage companies, Citigroup and all the rest? There was no plan. It doesn't seem to me like there is enough oversight. The oversight seems to be after the fact with this plan rather than what are you going to do and let's see if we approve of it.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for your call. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody, this hour. We, of course, will continue discussions on the economy down the road. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Tretter for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks for being a part of the hour, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We have another hour coming up. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.